Wouldn't you just love to have a nice cup of coffee with a shot of Ipecac in it? Yuck. Yeah, don't ever put Ipecac in your coffee. No, that just turns you right off. You don't want it now, do you? See how much better you feel? Oh, I need to pay homage where homage is due. Talking about growing old in the faith, Gina here is turning 91 in the ninth, and Bess is turning 90 today. So this is remarkable. We're the congregation of the 90s. We're thankful for that, and we really appreciate our older brethren a ton. If you're not 90, we appreciate you still, even if you're just a youngster down in your 80s somewhere. Believe me, this is a testament to God's truth and way, and a great blessing for all of the congregation to have so much wisdom of age amongst it. So, again, just very happy to comment on that. Oh, and I should get my notes out. That's right, they're back here. Okay. We always ask on Holy Day sermons, before we really get into the meat of the sermon, why are we here? And, of course, we're here to keep the Day of Atonement. Let's look at the Scripture. Get a little bit of little varied take on the Day of Atonement. We think a lot about fasting, and we think, you know, fasting helps us to think of repentance, because fasting and repenting go together in many respects. I mean, serious repentance and appealing to God. But let's look at there's another reason, by the way, why we're here, and I'm going to focus on that a little bit, but in chapter 23 of Leviticus, verse 26, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Also on the 10th day of the 7th month." Now, in God's calendar, this would be the 10th day of the 7th month. "Shall be the Day of Atonement. Shall be a holy convocation." That means it's a commanded assembly. Thus we're here. "And you shall afflict your souls." And it's a day of fasting. It's the only holy day there is a day of fasting. And you'll offer an offering made by fire, and so on. You know, the offering made by fire had to do with the Old Testament observance, with the tabernacle and the temple, the burnt offerings that were offered. Our offerings are different in the New Testament, because the temple was not in operation or not in force for the church itself. Even though, and this is kind of interesting, and there are other things we can comment about it, but even so, from the time of Christ's resurrection, death and resurrection, that was spring holy days of 31 AD, until 70 AD, it's almost 40 years of overlap. The temple was still in place and still in operation for 40 years, the first 40 years of the New Testament Church of God. And then the temple was destroyed by the Romans, along with hundreds of thousands of Jewish people that lived in Jerusalem. It was the great and terrible war, the Jewish-Roman war that took place at that time. So there was an overlap for them. That overlap disappeared in 70 AD, and all the rest of the generations of God's church, right down to our time, have not had the temple in existence. In fact, it has been an archaeological ruin since 70 AD. The Romans tore it all down, and then they knocked down the wall on the platform, because the Temple Mount had been elevated and made larger by King Herod. They knocked down the walls at the top of that, so where it was pretty much just a flat top that was left. Everything else was knocked down, just like Christ said, not one stone left upon another. You know, it was just raised it. They were not happy with the Jews. And they were less happy 50 years later. There was a second Jewish war with the Romans in 132 to 135 AD. And you think, wow. And it was another. The Jews have a very strong spirit of independence and determination. And they always have. That's, to some degree, shared by many of the other tribes of Israel. I think Manasseh certainly shares in that to a certain degree. Judah definitely did. So they had the temple in place then. Of course, the tabernacle was a portable temple in the time of the wandering, and then later the temple was built in Solomon's day. Let's go over just a page or two to chapter 25. Here's another thing that happens on the Day of Atonement. Anybody want to play in the band for special music on the Day of Atonement? And I don't mean the piano band. Your fingers have got energy stored. I'm talking about the trumpet band. Can you imagine playing the trumpet on the Day of Atonement? Well, let me tell you a weird thing. We used to pastor in Rockford, Illinois. We're going to get to see a bunch of our old brethren at the Feast in Wisconsin Dells this year. We're looking forward to that. But we could, in those days, they had a congregation, a combined congregation of about 350. And we could field from that 350 people, let me think, it was about a 70-voice choir and 45-person orchestra. 45 in the orchestra. Choir really had to sing. The amazing thing was that they, on the Day of Atonement, they loved to do the big show. They all wanted to perform. And on the rare occasion where they didn't perform, guess which ones wanted to perform special music? The brass section. And the trumpets, the trombone, and basically it was trumpets and trombones, I think a baritone as well. They didn't bother them to play on the Day of Atonement. I think it preoccupied them from feeling hungry. You know, they blew it all in the horn, and so they just didn't have any energy to feel hungry after that. But that must have been the case with the Levites. The Lord spoke to Moses, begin right at the beginning of the chapter, and on Mount Sinai. So this is right from Mount Sinai. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. Oh. Every seventh day is a day off for the land to? Nope, that's not what he means. That's a Sabbath for man. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year there will be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a land Sabbath. A Sabbath to the Lord, you'll neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard, and what grows of its own accord you shall harvest and not reap. You shall not harvest or reap. The grapes of your intended vine, for it's a year of rest for the land. Now, the Sabbath produce of the land may be food for you. In other words, you can go out to the fruit tree and you can pluck fruit to eat when you're hungry and maybe for the meal, but you don't harvest it to store it or anything like that or to sell it. It's a remarkable one. But guess what else happens on the land, during the land Sabbath? It was also something else. Verse 8. And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years. And the time of the 7 Sabbaths of the 7 years shall be to you 49 years. And then you will cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to blow. In the 49th year, the trumpet of the Jubilee to blow on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. So it was a command performance of the trumpeters of ancient Israel on the 49th year, the 7th Sabbath, the 7th land Sabbath, on the Day of Atonement. So in a sense, the Holy Day year began in the spring, but the agricultural year began in the spring with Passover. The agricultural year began in the autumn, technically with the Day of Atonement. And you think, well, hold it. How can you have an agricultural year begin in the fall? Ask a farmer. You don't begin your year in the spring. You begin in the fall to get ready for the next spring. That's planting time. And it takes your late fall and winter is preparation time to put the crop in the ground so that you can harvest it at harvest time and be ready to make preparations for the next year. So the land Sabbath celebration was on the Day of Atonement. And it was a time of freedom from oppression and freedom from other kinds of difficulties. It goes on, and we'll just read a little bit more here. You'll be the sound of the trumpet throughout your land. So it's not just sounded at the temple. This was to be have trumpets played in every village, probably on every ridge in Israel. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land of to its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee to you. So you see, you had 49 years, 7 times 7, seven cycles of 7 years. And then the 49th year, at the end of it, began the Jubilee year, which was the 50th year then. The Jubilee year was a time of liberty. Proclaim liberty through the land to its inhabitants. That's when those who were indentured servants in Israel, sometimes called Hebrew slaves, but they were primarily indentured servants, that's when they would be freed from their debt. If there was any time debt left, they were freed from it. The Day of Atonement, of all things, was a time of freedom. And you don't think, I don't feel free right now. My head aches. I don't ever feel free when I have a headache. But yes, it was. It was a time of freedom. It was a time for celebrating. But you notice, celebrating in the Bible is a little different than celebrating in the world today. Celebrating in the world today, everybody wants to strut around and blow their own horn and make a big scene. Everybody look at me, it's my happy day. Instead of celebrating the event. Celebrating the event was done, in this case, this was a huge event. The Jubilee year, the beginning of the Jubilee year, was a huge event. An annual, a year-long celebration. See, on the land Sabbath years, you didn't plant anything. Whatever grew voluntarily, you could eat when it came up, but you didn't plant anything, you didn't harvest anything. When you got to the 49th year, that's a land Sabbath, and you didn't plant or harvest anything. Whatever grew on volunteer, and there will always be volunteer growth in a garden and in the field, you could pluck and eat as you needed it. But right after the 49th year was the 50th year. That was the Jubilee year that began at the end of the 49th on the Day of Atonement. So the Day of Atonement marked the end of the agricultural year, the beginning of another one. And you had another land Sabbath. The 50th year was also a land Sabbath. You think, well, how can you do that? You know, where are you going to have the main foodstuffs to last past two harvests? You skip two harvests. Yes, because God said he would bless them in the sixth year, and he would double bless them in the 49th year so that they could do that. See, God was the reason for the celebration. It was his gift to man. That's what you were celebrating. And you celebrated it on the Day of Atonement, because that's the beginning of it. It's marvelous how God kind of gives us celebration that is one of savoring the meaning rather than senseless yelling and jumping up and down and acting silly. It savors the meaning of the day. And in the 50th year will be a jubilee to year. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather in the grapes of your untended vine. It is a jubilee. It will be a holy to you, and you'll eat the produce from the field. In other words, you can go out and eat it when it gets ripe. You just can't harvest it commercially or harvest it for storage, because God's already blessed you in the last big harvest was humongous. Which is why I think in the ancient Israel, when they were obeying God's laws properly, that root cellars were a big deal. Everybody needed a good place to store all of that food that God blessed in the sixth year or in the 49th year. So it was freedom. It was a time of freedom, a time of abundance. And the Day of Atonement was marking that off. Let's go to Romans chapter 6. In many ways, it was rather like the meaning of baptism, as Romans 6 is about the symbolism of baptism. Notice, start in verse 1. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? You know, is it God's most important, most favorite activity to forgive sins? That's the reasoning of some, that God's thing. He loves to give sin more than anything, so therefore if I sin more, God has more things to forgive, therefore I'm making God happy by doing things that he tells me not to do. That's the reasoning of mankind. That's not God's reasoning. Certainly not. How shall we who died to sin live any longer in it? Or you do you not know that as many as of us as were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? Therefore, into his death in the sense that it was a watery burial. It gets into that symbolism here in a minute. Therefore, we were buried with him through baptism into death. And you're not buried long when you're baptized. You're buried a second or two. Well, there was that one time. It was in a river. And I don't know what it was. He had a big wrist. It was the man I was baptizing. And he started drifting away. Fortunately, the church member's farm that we were at, he was downstream on a little bit of a sandbar, and he stepped into the water, and we rescued David, and then he was okay. But he slipped him out of my grasp. So it was longer than a second, but he was all right. You know, it was 3 or 4 seconds. And he came up sputtering, but it was just fine. His sins were just as forgiven. We shall be buried with him through baptism into death, so that Christ was just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father. Even so, we should walk in newness of life. It's a new beginning for us. And in a way, this day is kind of like that. And there are other aspects of God's way that represent that, a time of new beginnings. But it is like that. The atonement is a day of being subdued. Physically, and yet rejoicing tremendously. For if we've been united in the likeness of his death, certainly we shall be in the likeness of his resurrection, knowing that our old self was crucified with him, that the body of sin should be done away with, and we should no longer be slaves to sin. You see, the Hebrew slaves were freed on the Day of Atonement in the 49th year, at the end of the 49th year. They were freed on the Day of Atonement, no longer slaves. Now, we are no longer slaves of sin when we're baptized. For he who has died has been freed from sin. Now, if we died with Christ, we believe that we shall also live with him going on forward in celebrating that. Also over in verse 17 and 18 of this chapter, Romans 6. Verse 17, but God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered, and having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. And we in that sense are. We're slaves of God. We are, you know, in the most loving and wonderful celebratory way, we are deeply thankful that it is God who we serve. This is why we're here. We're celebrating that freedom from slavery, freedom from sin, freedom from the slavery of sin in particular. But we're not the only ones that this day is about. The devil gets his due on the Day of Atonement. The devil gets his due, and he does. He needs it. Let's go back to Leviticus again. This chapter 16, Leviticus 16. Leviticus 16 is a very detailed ceremony. There were specific ceremonies for each of God's annual holy days that the priesthood would go through. Certain sacrifices, certain events that would take place. But an entire chapter is written for the Day of Atonement. It's really remarkable, and it's got some really odd things that happen, and we're going to look at the odd things in particular. Notice in verse 5 of Leviticus 16, let's read down there in verse 5. After, you know, the ceremony starts, Aaron shall come into the holy place in verse 3. Actually, we'll begin there. That's a good place. This is for the Day of Atonement, as you'll see. And he'll come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and of a ram as a burnt offering. And he'll put the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body, the uniform of the priest. And he shall be girded with a linen sash, and with a linen turban shall he be attired. These are the holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. And cleanliness was always also vital, and it was the constant washings that were somewhat symbolic later of the ceremony of baptism, which is a washing, a spiritual washing, as it were. And verse 5, he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel 2 kids of the goats as a sin offering, and one ram as a burnt offering. So there are 2 goats, 2 kids, and then a ram. So Aaron will offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, in verse 6, and make an atonement for himself and for his house. And then he'll take the two goats. And this is the interesting part. And we're going to come back and read that part, but I want you to skip forward in the chapter to verse 15. He shall kill the goat of the sin offering. So one will be sacrificed in the usual manner of a sin offering, which is for the people. And he'll bring its blood inside the veil. Now, let me explain the veil. This was in the tabernacle, the portable temple. So it's a scaled-down version of what Solomon's temple will be, or would be, rather. In Solomon's temple, if you wanted to envision, what did the temple, what did the tabernacle look like? What size, what kind of a room are we in? Rectangular. Bingo. Rectangular. But it was divided into about thirds. So two-thirds was toward the front, near the door. And then there was a tapestry that covered, that served as a wall, essentially, a curtain wall, for the other room. The main room was the holy place. That's where the altar of incense was, which also would have been the heating source when it was needed for the tabernacle. There were tables on the side, kind of like we have tables, but these were tables covered with gold where the showbread was laid out, symbolic bread being shared with God. Behind the curtain was where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. And the high priest, for official ceremonies, only went back there on the Day of Atonement. That's the only time he entered the most holy place. Or as in Hebrew, it would have been, translating the Hebrew word for holy, it would have been the holy, holy. The holy of holies. In Hebrew, to emphasize something, you simply repeat the word. So instead of, we would say the holiest, we use the EST, end on the end, that we do for good, better, best. Never let it rest till your good is better and your better best. So that's how the best is with the EST. It was the bestest, as some kids try to add to best with that. But they would just repeat the word. That means best. So if you were to say the word is holy, then holy, holy means the holiest place, or the holy of holies, as we sometimes render it into English. He shall kill the goat of the sin offering, in verse 15, for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil. That means inside that anteroom, the back room, the rearmost room, the westernmost room of the tabernacle, where the Ark of the Covenant is, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat. The mercy seat is this representation of God's throne that is built into the cover of the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant itself is a trunk of sorts, but it has this beautiful, ornate covering that is all overlaid with gold. And it has two angels there whose wings overstretch the mercy seat, which is obviously the symbolic of God's throne. Because in heaven, there are two cherubim who are always on duty, and their wings overstretch the throne of God. So this is a reflection of what's up there. It's the only time that God sanctioned the building of statuary that represented something in heaven. But God had to sanction it. It wasn't for man to just decide to do. And he'll go inside the veil and do with the blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. So he does that with the goat. And he'll make an atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions and for all their sins. And he shall do the tabernacle of meeting with which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. And there will be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make an atonement in the holy place until he comes out, that he may make an atonement for himself, for his household, and for the assembly of Israel. Again, the atonement means covering. It's covering the sins of Israel, in that sense, forgiving them. So it's a remarkable ceremony of using these two goats, and one is designated as the Lord's goat, and the other one is another goat. And we'll explain that. We'll go down to verse 20. And when he has made an end of atoning the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. The live goat. And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning their sins, putting them on the head of the goat. So this is totally different kind of ceremony. It's unique in all of the laws of the sacrifices for this one goat on the Day of Atonement. One goat is sacrificed in the usual manner, representing the sacrifice, ultimate sacrifice of Christ, of course. The other goat isn't sacrificed. The high priest lays his hands on that goat, probably with his fingers around the horns to hold it in place, and then he confesses over it all the sins of the children of Israel, the sins of the nation over the past year, because it's done on an annual basis with the implications from, you know, all the years before and all the years that would come. You confess those iniquities on that goat, and it's their transgression. So, well, you think, well, just a minute, didn't that other goat represent or in advance the forgiveness of the sins of all of Israel? It certainly did, through the shed blood of Christ, when we look at it from the New Testament's perspective. So that makes this one even odder, that he confesses over it or lays upon it the sins of all the children of Israel, as the word for confess can be rendered, and their transgressions concerning their sins, putting them on the head of the goat. And he then, notice, he doesn't sacrifice it. This is the one offering in all the Levitical system that is released. He shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. And when it says a suitable, what do you mean, a suitable man? Okay, you're going to take a goat that is just selected from the flock, probably not broke to lead. So if you're going to lead the goat, have you ever led an animal that is not broke to lead? Most haven't, because they don't get to be on farms as much as we used to be. But my cousin had to break a yearling milk cow calf for his 4-H project. And Daisy, which became a very wonderful pet and a wonderful milk cow in her day, initially did not want to be led anywhere. So he had a rope around her neck and she wouldn't follow. Therefore, it was my job to teach her to follow. So he would pull and I would shove. And then pretty soon she got the idea. It took a couple days of that, and then when he would give a tug on the rope, she'd just come right along. You know, we broke her to lead is what we called that back in the West. Well, this goat wouldn't probably not have been broken to lead. So he'd be a suitable man if he's going to take it on the rope and lead it out into the wilderness. At least part of the time, you want it to follow. Because otherwise you've got a goat that's doing this with four legs, burying it into the earth and into the sand, and he's really difficult to lead. Or if he wouldn't lead, then the guy would have to pick it up and carry it. Now, you can carry a goat, a yearling goat, for a good while, and a big, strong guy could carry it for a long ways, but it would require a big, strong guy to carry it for a long ways. He would carry it in out to an uninhabited land. Notice verse 22, the goat shall bear itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he'll release the goat in the wilderness. He had to walk miles away from wherever Israel was camped on their wandering years. Miles away, probably over whatever ridge or two that there were, to where it was far away from everybody, and then he would release it. It wasn't killed. It wasn't sacrificed in the usual manner. Now, that seems odd, but it really isn't odd when you compare this passage of the suitable man taking the goat out to an uninhabited place and read this in Revelation chapter 20. Let's go to Revelation chapter 20 now. The suitable man was representational or symbolic of a great angel. Verse 1 of chapter 20 of Revelation, "And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand." This is why I think the guy had to lead the goat, that he had a lead rope, or maybe a chain, but probably a rope. In Satan's case, it's a chain. "And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old," which tells us that it was Satan who was the serpent in the Garden of Eden. He manifested himself as the snake. that dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years and cast him into a bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him, so he should deceive the nations no more until 1,000 years were finished. See, the ceremony of in Hebrew, the goat that was allowed to live but was taken out by the suitable man was called the Azazel. The Azazel goat was then taken out, symbolic of Satan. The symbolism of the ceremony is dramatically similar. So we find then that this holy day, the Day of Atonement, is not just a day of repentance. That's how it's viewed by and large by the Jewish community. Bear in mind, the Jewish community has lost a great deal the knowledge of the Bible that they once had because they follow the religion called Judaism, which didn't exist. The seeds of it were there, but it didn't exist until after the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. When you read Jewish histories and find out when Judaism, what we know as modern Judaism, when that started, they will tell you 70 AD. They don't say that it began with the Exodus. Oh, that's their heritage. And they have the Bible. But Judaism is a different religion than the Old Testament religion of God. Dramatically different and recognized by those who keep it as being different. Now, granted, they draw from the Bible, but so does traditional Christianity, doesn't it? But the religion of traditional Christianity is very different from the religion taught by the 12 apostles who had been trained by Christ. And the establishment of the true Church of God, of which we are modern-day manifestation. It's important to understand these things so you don't get caught up in thinking, well, if I'm more Jewish, I'm more righteous. Wrong. Yeah, that's completely wrong. And the Jewish historians would explain to you, oh, that's wrong. It's a different religion based on some of the things of the previous one, but you have to add in all of the teaching of their rabbis from that time forward. When the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, hundreds of thousands, and I forget exactly, I'm thinking it's between 400,000 and 600,000 Jews died in Jerusalem, the battle for Jerusalem, which was the battle when the temple was destroyed. It was a last stand in that war. And, you know, they were defending what they thought they should defend, and Rome was defeating what it thought it had to defeat. But the temple was completely wiped out at that time, and it left the Sadducees were primarily the priesthood. Of the religious political parties, they were combined units in the New Testament. Christ did battle constantly with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Those were the two dominant parties. There were several other small ones of less significance. By far, these were the two big ones. The Sadducees were the priests. In the battle for Jerusalem, it stands to reason that the priesthood would have been decimated. Not totally wiped out, but decimated. And it was, because that was their claim to fame. Because the Pharisees' claim to fame in the days of Christ was that they ran the synagogues in the local communities. They were the synagogue masters. They were the rabbis, who weren't necessarily of the tribe of Levi, mostly of the tribe of Judah. Paul was of the tribe of Benjamin, you know, one of the tribe that was tossed into Judah, added in, to be the two tribes of the south when the 10 tribes of the north rebelled. And Levi was there too, but not included in the counting as God counted them. The Levites were taken out of the count of the 12 tribes when Joseph got Manasseh and Ephraim at full tribal status, or when they were made in full tribal status. It wasn't Joseph's doing, it was Abraham's, because God told him to. The Levites were the priesthood tribe and the social services tribe of the nation, scattered strategically through the tribes when they were taken into the promised land so that they could be the doctors and the teachers and the educators. That was what they were dedicated to, that kind of work. Plus, going and serving on their rotational basis down at the temple or the tabernacle prior to the temple being built. The Sadducees, who were the priesthood, numbers were decimated dramatically at the first Jewish war. The Pharisees, on the other hand, didn't all live in Jerusalem. Most of them didn't live in Jerusalem. They lived in the outer communities. And they ended up surviving. And they are the ones who are the progenitors of the tribe or of the Judaic religion. And that's why it is called rabbinical Judaism, because the rabbis were the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the rabbis. So rabbinical or Pharisaic Judaism is what has become the religion of Judaism down to the modern time. Very different from the Old Testament religion of God. All right, so we see the connection here. That's just an aside that I think is important for us to get clarified, because we have a confusing time, and some people think, well, if I'm more Jewish, I'm more righteous, and that's not right. No, you're more righteous if we're doing what God says, and we go to the Bible directly for that. But what about this prayer? You know, back there in Leviticus, I'm going to give you the title of the sermon here in a minute. A Prayer for the Devil is essentially what the title is. I'll give you another word for it to add in there a little later, but I'll have to spell it. Back in Leviticus, we find that the high priest took that goat, the live goat, in verse 20 of chapter 25 or chapter 16 of Leviticus, when he's made an end of atoning the holy place, that's the high priest, and so on, then he shall bring the live goat. And initially, the high priest was Aaron. And so Aaron, verse 21, Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it the iniquities of the children of Israel. So it's a ceremony. Now, what is typically when you confess the sins of something, what typically are you doing? It's a prayer. It's a ceremony where he lays hands on the goat and he asks this prayer on the goat. And in that prayer, he confesses the sins of Israel on the head of that goat. So what kind of a prayer? Because this goat, as we now see, represents the devil, represents Satan. That was what it was meant to do then as well. What kind of a prayer is there for the devil? The prayer that Aaron would recite over the goat, that's the question. What kind of a prayer would that be? Because it said, we just read it, he confesses the iniquities of the children of Israel, all their transgressions concerning all their sins, and puts them on the head of the goat. In a sense, his confession of Israel's sins is a prayer for the devil, not just for the goat. The goat was just a symbol. But it was a prayer for the devil, not a prayer to the devil. Get your prepositions straight here. Not a prayer to. We don't pray to the devil, we pray to God. But it's a prayer for the devil. Now, you could be prayed for by someone who is happy with you, and they're praying for you in a positive way. You could be prayed for by someone who is not happy with you, and it would not be a prayer that would be what we would call for you, but more against you. And that's essentially what we're doing, looking at here, the latter. What kind of prayer do you pray for the devil? And the answer is, it's an imprecatory prayer. Now, there's the title, the word to put into the title later. I'll spell it. I-M-P-R-E-C, imprec, A-T-O-R-Y, atory, imprecatory. It's asking God to crush a clear enemy of his, and an enemy which is an aggressive adversary of truth and freedom. In God's people, a clear adversary. It's a prayer against a clear adversary of God's. That's what an imprecatory prayer is. This is not a soft and gentle prayer. This is a prayer that, frankly, we have many examples of in the Old Testament. Let's look at them. Just a sampling. Psalm 58. David was good, and sometimes we wonder, why would David say that in a prayer? The Psalms, many of the Psalms were prayers. Most of the Psalms probably were prayers. Some of even the ones that were made into songs were prayers that were made into a song. Psalm 58. We'll start in verse 3. to set the tone, and then we'll focus on verse 6 through 10. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. Their poison is like the poison of a serpent. They are like the deaf cobra that stops its ear and will not heed the voice of charmers, charming ever so skillfully. You ever seen the snake charmers? They're playing a little flute, and this is a live king cobra coming up out of the basket that they're doing to, and it sort of sways to the sound, or I'm not sure if it's swaying to the sound, but partly that, and partly the movement of the flute. And then they play another tune, and it slowly goes back down. And people who come by and watch this are impressed, and they throw money in the guy's hat, or give it to his monkey. Hold it, there's no monkey involved here. Snake would eat it. So that's the snake charmer. Well, these people are like a deaf snake. They don't listen to reason. Break their teeth in their mouth, O God. This is important why we have to have the snake background. Break their teeth in their mouth, O God. Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Eternal. Let them flow away as waters which run continually. When he bends his bows, let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. Now, we just shifted analogies, by the way, from breaking teeth to destroying arrows. So when you have arrows coming at you, if you can imagine this from an old Western or reading the history of, you know, going up against American Indians who were phenomenal archers, but by the way, they weren't the first phenomenal archers, the English were. Well, before the English, there were the Scythians and the Parthians and so on. Archery has always been terrifying for those who were at the receiving end of the arrows. And you can appreciate that, I think. When he bends his bows, let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. You imagine an arrow being shot, and you know its deadly force is coming, and it gets past the bow, and then it breaks in about a dozen pieces and splatters all over the ground right in front of the shooter. Doesn't reach the person it was shot at all. Oh, that would be good if it was you that was being shot at. That would be really good. And then it goes on to say, let them be like a snail, which melts away as it goes. So the arrow goes zooming. And then the zoom is more like a snail, slowly. And you know, snails leave that little trail behind them, the slime trail. And the slime trail just disappears slowly behind the snail. That's a really, really slow arrow, which is easily dodged, you know. Let them be like that. Or, and you know, this is an inspired imagination that David is writing from. And let it just melt away as it goes, like a stillborn child of a woman, that they may not see the sun. A very sad aspect of the analogy there. But still, David is not praying for his enemies to be successful. He's praying for the enemies of Israel, which were God's nation back then, to be protected from those who would destroy them. And there were many who would destroy them. This is an imprecatory prayer. David waxed eloquent at times with his imprecatory prayers. Let's go to Psalm 69 as another example. Psalm 69. And I've only got three of these examples in the Psalms. There are lots and lots and lots of them. But they will help you to understand those passages in the Psalms. Sometimes it isn't an entire Psalm, it's just a portion of it. But when you read that, you think, why was David saying that? Well, this is why. It's an imprecatory prayer. So in Psalm 69, we want to pick it up about verse 24. He wants God to deal with these bad guys. I think we can actually pick it up a little earlier. Verse 19. You know my reproach and my shame and my dishonors. My adversaries are all before you. So this is about David's adversaries that he's praying. Reproach has broken my heart. I'm full of heaviness. I look for someone to take pity, but there was none, and for comforters, and I found none. They also gave me gall for my food, and my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Where does that echo from? Christ, when he was crucified. They gave him gall and they gave him vinegar. So he was surrounded by his enemies. So David is speaking of that. Now, that puts it, and you begin to see, okay, I'm beginning to understand imprecatory as being against those who are against God. Let their table become a snare before them, in verse 22, and their well-being a trap. Let their eyes be darkened so they do not see. Make their loins shake continually. Imagine a bunch of shaking lions out there. We understand shaking loins. You know, we're kind of quivering with fear. Pour out your indignation upon them. Let your wrathful anger take hold of them. Make their dwelling place be desolate. And let no one live in their tents. And by the way, let their dwelling place be desolate. That is quoted by Peter in Acts 1, verse 20. Not Act 1, verse 20, but Acts chapter 1, verse 20. And it was a reference to Judas Iscariot. Let his dwelling place be desolate. It was. And then he had to be replaced on the 12 apostles. Let no one live in their tents, for they persecute the ones that you have struck, and talk of the grief of those that you have wounded. Add iniquity to their iniquity, and let them not come into your righteousness. Let them be blotted out of the book of living, and not written with the righteous. This is an imprecatory prayer against the enemies of God's people. A very powerful imprecatory prayer, I might add. Now, let's go to Psalm 139 for our other example. Psalm 139. When you stop and think about that as we get ready to read this one, remember, imprecatory prayer is the kind of prayer that Aaron, or the succeeding high priest, Eleazar was his son, and Phinehas was Eleazar's son. Those are the two after Aaron. That they would lay hands on that goat, and they would offer an imprecatory prayer confessing the sins of Israel. But there would be a certain blame for those sins, not just of the Israelites, but the blame that came on others, specifically on the devil. So, Psalm 139, verse 19. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men, for they speak against you wickedly. Speak against God wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Eternal, who hate you? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them my enemies. Now, this is obviously the place where the perfect hatred comes out. And you're like, what do you mean a perfect hatred? How can hatred be perfect? Well, technically it isn't perfect. Like we use perfect, it's the other meaning of perfect, which means complete. Complete hatred of evil. Because they are manifestations of evil. They have chosen to be like that. When Jesus says to pray for our enemies, our real enemies are not those who we are inconvenienced by or merely irritated at. I mean, we get irritated at each other or family members and such, or simply put out at. That's not what it means. You know, we don't want to make enemies out of those who are not our enemies by any means. We're not talking about those who are therefore just inconvenience us or irritate us. Quite often, the imprecatory prayer is the prayer that we should pray for the really evil aspects of society, and the most evil aspects of unseen society, as we're going to get into. Evil must not be sugar-coated, and yet we see that happening right around us in the world today. We see ourselves being conditioned to think, oh, really, it's not that bad. You know, so what if, you know, they tortured and maimed and beheaded this person? You know, they really felt they didn't like him, you know, didn't fit into their peer group. So they... It wasn't a good match. So you don't stop talking about the evil, grisly murder, and you start making excuses for the murderers. It's easy to get lulled into that in this society, brethren. We must be very careful. The imprecatory prayer smacks us back into reality and keeps us there. For example, Isaiah 5:20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Sorry about the epicac in your coffee example at the beginning. Now, Is it just mankind we're talking about? No, it isn't. Let me show you where the real evil is and what this day is really about. Let's go to chapter 2 of Ephesians. Another way of asking this, introducing this section is, how much of man's sins are also the devil's sins? Ephesians 2. This particular passage makes it very clear. In verse 1, Paul says, and you, meaning the brethren, and Christ, because the previous verse in the end of chapter 1 states that Christ is head over all things to the church, which is his body, the church of God. The true church of God is the body of Christ. We're part of that historical church that has existed since the time of Christ forward. The fullness of him who fills all and in all. And you, he made alive, and he did, he made alive when we went through the ceremony of baptism and then received the laying on of hands afterwards. It's a separate ceremony, but went together. We received God's Spirit. He made us spiritually alive when that happened. We were dead in trespasses and sin until he did. And looking back at our past life, in which those trespasses and sins, you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. Who is the prince of the power of the air? It is none other than the great fallen angel, Satan. Started out as Lucifer, a light bringer. But he did not choose to remain that. Sin is a choice. And Satan and the demons chose what they chose. And now he is the spirit that works in the sons of disobedience. He deceives, just like he deceived Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. He destroys. He is a destroyer of goodness especially, but a destroyer of anything that is anything that God did and everything else God did. So everything that he can destroy makes him happy. That's why he produces children of wrath. Prince of the power of the air works in the sons of disobedience, among whom also we once conducted ourselves in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as others. We were a part of this world. For the few who are multi-generational within the church, prior to your conversion, which was when you were a young adult, you were a part of this world. Maybe not as much as earlier generations in your family or other families, but you were a part as well. We're all influenced by Satan. We have to overcome that. We have to watch out for that. He works in the children of disobedience. He fosters disobedience. He creates anger. Anger is his money. He pays off in anger. And then, well, that's a bad deal. Oh, yeah. That's a terrible deal. That kind of wrath destroys relationships, wrecks families. Ephesians chapter 6. Go to the end of the chapter, end of the book. Ephesians 6. This is, of course, the area about the armor of God. Why are you wearing the armor of God? Well, because you need to. Finally, brethren, be strong, verse 10, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand the wiles or the methodology of the devil. That's what wiles is a reference to, the wiles or the tactics, the methods of the devil. What are the methods of the devil? Well, you're wearing armor. The analogy then is that there are ways that you fought in every culture and era had its battle tactics. You know, this we sometimes think that the more modern sword-bearing armored knights of the Middle Ages didn't have any tactics except trying to spear a guy off of his horse with their lance. And while he was trying to do that to them, no, they had their own version of the martial arts in Europe. And it had to do with the sword and the tactics. I've got a book that explains and illustrates the whole thing. There was a very sophisticated fighting machine, which is why they conquered the Arabs who controlled the Holy Land, as they referred to it at that time. And they got careless, of course, and the Arabs were not bad fighters themselves, and so then they would get conquered again by the Arabs, and back and forth, and during the Crusades, back and forth the knights of Europe against the Arab warriors of the Middle East went. Back and forth they went. Because they had their wiles, their tactics, their ways of fighting and wrestling and such. And then dropping on down, for we wrestle not against flesh and blood, in verse 12, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And we thought we were against people. No, we're not fighting against people. We are for people. We are people ourselves in God's church. No, we are fighting against principalities and powers and rulers of darkness of this age, spiritual hosts of wickedness. We're fighting Satan and the demons and the influence that they have on us. So that's why we use these spiritual hosts. The spiritual armor is designed to protect us from that and to counterattack. It's not all just defensive. It is certainly defensive when you get into the armor of God. That starts in verse 14. You gird your waist with truth, and the Roman soldiers wore a kilt of sorts, a heavy overlapped leather kilt. Sometimes it had plate armor on the heavy leather straps. That would deflect the thrust of a sword. And the breastplate of righteousness, you know, that was battle armor in the sense, and it would take blows from an axe or sword and not penetrate, otherwise you'd be dead. That's why they had that. And your feet were shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Everybody thinks it was Roman sandals. It was Roman boots. Romans probably did wear sandals in some places, but they wore boots. You know the danger of fighting in sandals? Gravel. Next time you're wearing your sandals, go find some gravel and wander carelessly through it until you get some gravel under your foot, inside your sandal, and you'll realize this isn't such a good thing. If I had my boots on, that wouldn't have happened. Right. Well, the Romans knew how to make boots. I don't know why we got preoccupied with sandals. And then the shield of faith. And the shield is you think, well, yeah, that's all defensive, though. Everything's defensive. No, it's not. They knew how to kick. They knew how to use their hips to shove somebody sideways and off their balance when they got grappled into a warfare situation. They would use their shield to protect from, you know, that was protective indeed. And the Roman soldiers would throw their shield up as a unit, and the rear ranks would throw their shields up like this. They'd carry them above their heads, and the front and the side ranks all carried them like this. And they called it a turtle. That unit of a legion would move forward, and there wasn't anything short of massive rocks out of catapults that could break through it. Arrows would all be stuck into the shields. And if they were fiery arrows, their shields had a heavy leather outer covering, which they soaked in water before they went to battle. Precisely for that, it would put out fire arrows by having that wet leather instead of being burned through so that the enemy could get into their deeper ranks. But that shield was also used to thrust and push and parry. It was both defensive and offensive. Likewise, the sword. The sword thrusts. Sometimes it parries a blow, and then it strikes a blow. It's defensive and offensive at the same time. Everything in God's armor is defensive and offensive. We're not just sitting here hunkered down being hammered on by Satan. We are fighting back. Everything that God has given us is to be used to fight back against the spiritual hosts of wickedness, to resist the sin that they want us to become disobedient and follow. There's a whole different view of the Day of Atonement when you think about getting battle ready for the spiritual battles that we have day to day, from this atonement to the next atonement, and for the ones that get very close to the end of the age, and we are, by the way, very close to the end of the age, and it's going to get more intense, not less. Notice Isaiah 6:24 talking about these spiritual hosts of wickedness. Isaiah 24. Verses 21 to 23 of Isaiah 24. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will punish on high the host of exalted ones, and on earth the kings of the earth. They will be gathered together as prisoners are gathered into the pit, and they will be shut up in prison, and after many days they'll be punished. Interesting, isn't it? And the moon will be disgraced and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion in Jerusalem and before his elders gloriously. So it's in anticipation of the second coming of Christ. But God will punish on high the hosts of exalted ones, and on earth the kings of the earth. So God will, when we know the prophecies, we've read through them. Feast of Trumpets was certainly one where we covered some of those prophecies of Christ's return and the battle array of the enemy, of the man's armies, what's left of them, to fight off this invader from outer space who they know is Jesus Christ, or if they don't know, they will find out right away. They fight against him, and he punishes them, destroys them. There at the Battle of Armageddon, the battle actually is in Mount of Olives in the Valley of Jehoshaphat that's down below it and off to the north of it. But the staging area was at Armageddon, 70 miles north. So it's a massive army trooping down and being destroyed. Destroyed probably partly like the army of the Iraqis trying to get away from Kuwait City back in the Gulf War I in 1991. The U.S. Air Force just destroyed the long line of machinery going north, and a lot of people with it, a lot of the army with it. Well, God will do that as well then. And it's a huge battle scene. You know, it kind of makes you think, well, there's some excitement in the Day of Atonement. I don't sit around moping and feeling bad and wishing I didn't put Epicac in my coffee. And I wish I had some cream for my coffee, you know, the really sweet, nice cream that floats back up onto the top, you know. Oh, that would be nice and refreshing and good, wouldn't it? Later. The Lord will punish the hosts of the exalted ones, not just those on earth, but it says he will punish on high the host of the exalted ones. Who are they? Oh, well, let's ask Daniel, chapter 10. Daniel, chapter 10. Now, here's a dramatic story. And it has to do with fasting, since we're Day of Atonement. It's very appropriate. Begin in verse 1, first three verses. In the year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belshazzar. And the message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message, but had understanding of the vision. And in those days, verse 2, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. And they, well, that's a good thing. And I ate no pleasant food, nor meat nor wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all. Now some say, well, it was a modified fast. I don't really think so. It sounds really like just a regular fast for 3 weeks. You think, well, he'd die if he did it for 3 weeks. Well, he would if God wasn't with him. Sure, maybe that might be true. I mean, he was 85, though. He was pretty old and tough. He's kind of like the congregation here. He could take it. Christ fasted for 40 days, Elijah did. When God is with you, the long fasting isn't a problem. I ate no pleasant food, nor meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all. For 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. And on the 24th day of the fast, I was by the side of the river, which is the Tigris. And I looked, and behold, there was a man clothed in linen, and whose waist was girded with the gold of Ophaz, and his body was like beryl, and his face appearance of lightning, and his eyes like torches of fire, and his arms like feet like burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision. So this was a vision that Daniel saw. But if somebody was there, he was looking at him. And the other men with him didn't see the vision. They just felt terrified. And they ran and hid. And in verse 8, therefore I was alone when I saw this great vision, and no strength remained in me. I mean, he'd been fasting for most of 3 weeks. My vigor was turned to frailty, and I retained no strength. But I heard the sound of his words, and I heard the sound of his words. I was in a deep sleep on my face on the ground. And behold, a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved. Now this is an angel, as we're going to see. This is an angel speaking to Daniel. O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright. For I have now been sent to you. While he was speaking this word, I stood up trembling. And he said to me, do not fear, Daniel. From the first day that you set your heart to understand and humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I have come because of your words. However, verse 13, but the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. But now I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, that the vision refers to many days yet to come. And what was going on here? Let's go back over that. I was sent here because of your words, but in verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And then, behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I've been left there alone with the kings of Persia. What we have is a holy angel fighting demons. The demons that were the inciting powers behind the kingdom of Persia. See, we think of a human governments as merely human. The camouflage is evolution. The camouflage is literal. You just focus on totally on the human existence and on the physical existence. And the world doesn't know that there's a spirit existence too. There are fallen angels who are demons. And this is Satan's world. He is the prince of the power of the air. He's called the king of the earth, the god of this, the ruler or god of this world. In 2 Corinthians 4:4, he's called that. And so this angel that was sent, we don't know who it was that was sent to him, but we only know the names of three angels. One is Lucifer, and that's Satan, of course. Number two is Michael, this Michael right here, also known as Michael, an archangel in Revelation chapter 12, and Gabriel. Gabriel is the one who came to Joseph and Mary to tell them that the Christ child would be born to them. So maybe it was Gabriel, and then Michael came to help him. We don't know for sure. That will be something for the first Bible study in the millennium. Aren't we going to look forward to those Bible studies in the millennium when we can ask Jesus all those questions? What about this? What about that? And he'll explain it and won't it be grand? We'll understand. Like Daniel sought to understand, we will understand. So you see, the devil is involved in the sins of man, though. There are demon spirits that mess with the world's governments. And when world leaders act crazy, lunatic, almost, and or incredibly vicious, they're getting help. They may not even know they're getting the help, but they're getting help. And I'm not talking just about today. I'm reading a very, very, very sad book. It is the history of the emperors that were ruling in Europe going into World War I. And it's just very sad. You can see that it was more than just human hands driving World War I and then World War II as well. Let's go back to Isaiah. As we finish this day of fasting, let's finish with the fasting chapter, Isaiah 58. There are several verses that are particularly germane to what we're looking at here and what we're talking about. So usually we do call this the fasting chapter because it talks about fasting. Cry aloud, verse 1 it says, cry aloud, spare not, lift up your voice like a trumpet. Tell my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sins. And it goes on talking about that. And then it talks about the wrong kind of fasting that the world does. In fact, in this is the middle of verse 3. In fact, in the day of your fast you find pleasure and exploit your laborers. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate and to strike with a fist of wickedness. Brethren, we have to be very careful that we don't want to strike with a fist of wickedness. And obviously, we're not great politicians, world leaders, emperors of empires. No, no. But we can have that attitude manifest itself down to the personal level. We don't want to be like that. We want to be at peace with God. And the Day of Atonement really is leading us to be at peace with God, to be at one with God, as we break the word apart into the English counter pieces of it, to be at one with God and at peace and not angry with others. You know, shed the anger. The anger comes from someplace, not necessarily from us. But if we open ourselves to it, it'll be thrust in, just like it is on the national and international scale and has been throughout history. Indeed, you fast for strife and debate, and strike with the fist of wickedness. You will not fast as you do this day to make your voice heard on high. That's our purpose, to seek God, that our prayers will get through and be more stronger prayers. Is this a fast that I have chosen? A day for a man to afflict his soul and to bow down his head like a bulrush and split out sackcloth and ashes? Would you call this a fast and an acceptable day to the Lord? You know, putting on a big show. I'm fasting. Here, we dress up. We go to church, we fellowship, we drink a little air coffee afterwards out of invisible cups. No Epicac in the air coffee. I'm joking about that, of course. No, we enjoy the fellowship. Subdued, more so than we normally are, because blood sugar's running low. But we're thankful to be here. Is not this the fast I've chosen, verse 6? To loose the bonds of wickedness. We are in a spiritual battle against the powers of spiritual wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free. Those who are oppressed need to be freed. The world is oppressed badly. We have been freed because God has called us to the knowledge of His truth. Do we value the power of that freedom God has given us? Or does it get shuffled off into the other interests of everything going on around the world and all of our other things that are going on? We need to always value and hold as a treasure the fact that God has set us free from this bondage that the world is still in. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring to your house the poor that are cast out, and when you see the naked to cover him and to hide yourself, not to hide yourself from your own flesh? And certainly we have at times ways we help out in that, but think about the power we will have as resurrected saints in the millennium, especially in the early generations, helping people and strengthening them. Then your light will bring forth this kind of a fast. Your light will break forth like the morning. Your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you, and the glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. And then you shall call, and the Lord will answer, and you shall cry, and He will say, "Here I am." Now, we're in a battle right now, and the world tomorrow will be back in the building business. Right now, we fight a battle for our existence, for the existence of mankind, and for all that has that we can do in the work of God of spreading the gospel, which is the seeds of the future of mankind and the future ultimately of God's family. On the Day of Atonement, we're humbled before God through fasting. Thus, we come under the sacrifice of Christ for our sins, pictured by the Lord's goat. At the same time, we pray, like the high priest, a powerful imprecatory prayer that God will swiftly bring His judgment upon the devil and upon those who are the devil's agents, and upon his demons as well, and by extension, the wicked among men. There is a prayer for the devil. It is an imprecatory prayer that throws or confesses, as the high priest did, the sins of mankind upon Satan, for he is the full partner of sin.